Before I begin, I'd like to thank Ira B. Metetsky, the Wolfpack's Werowance, for inviting me to speak at today's assembly, as well as Marilyn Schaffer, who helped coordinate matters. It's a pleasure to be here. I've been asked to speak about my stage adaptation of The Red Box. As some of you may know, my adaptation of the fourth Nero Wolfe novel receives its premiere next spring at Park Square Theater in St. Paul, Minnesota. Adapting The Red Box is part and parcel of my long-standing interest in theater and the mystery. I've been working as an actor and a writer for over a quarter of a century, but I've been a mystery fan for much longer than that. In fact, my earlier plays have drawn upon various aspects of the mystery, often those related to noir, are fairly Catholic. Hammett and Chandler rate high on my list of authors, but so do Ellery Queen, Nicholas Blake, Patrick Quinton, and, I hope it goes without saying, but I will say it nonetheless, Rex Stout. Given my proclivities as a reader, I sometimes wonder why it took me so long to put my two great loves, the mystery and the theater, together. Crime and theater have always had a really beneficial relationship. As an extremity of human behavior, crime is dramatic. We see this not only in plays that are specifically mystery plays, but in works that we might not immediately think of as mysteries. Oedipus Rex, of course, and Medea, which could be viewed in a certain light as an ancient Cornell Woolrich revenge story. The bride wore poison. Moving to the 20th century, we encounter other plays that also draw upon the mystery. O'Neill's Morning Becomes Electra is, among other things, a rip-roaring murder melodrama. And Pinter's The Birthday Party is a version of The Killers. A man with a past tries to hide from it, but finds that he can't. Now, neither of these plays are mysteries per se, but they demonstrate that both O'Neill and Pinter knew their sensational literature. There are certainly fewer mystery plays being written these days, or at least being produced, than occurred in Broadway's golden age. The situation can be compared, I think, to that of the pulp magazines when radio and television took over the pulp's audience by providing short-form mysteries that you could listen to or watch. But plays are still being written and produced, though the home of the mystery play is, with an occasional exception every now and then, no longer on Broadway. It thrives in regional and community theaters. Audiences love a good mystery, whether it's one of the seemingly inexhaustible supplies of plays about Sherlock Holmes, or a new adaptation of a classic mystery novel, or an original taking place in, say, New York City. In a good mystery play, there's always a moment when the entire audience leans forward. Oh, they want to know. They have to know. Have to know what's going to happen next. Oh, that is one of the prime experiences that a theater-going audience can have. I've done a number of adaptations over the years. The first was a fairly loose adaptation of The Bacchae, which I turned into a one-man show, and I performed it in Los Angeles and New Orleans. The second adaptation was a rather more faithful version of another of Euripides' works, Medea, actually, which was produced by the now-defunct Jean Cocteau Repertory Theater here in the city 6 or 7 years ago. The third adaptation is based on Ellery Queen's classic 1942 novel, Calamity Town, and it had its first production early this fall in Claremont, New Hampshire. Claremont is the town that Dene and Lee, Queen's creator, based the fictional town of Wrightsville upon, and it was only fitting that the play should have its premiere there. The fourth adaptation is, of course, The Red Box. When I was searching for another Golden Age great to bring to the stage, Nero Wolfe was the obvious choice. I'd read Mr. Stout's books for years, I'd listened to the various radio versions of the books, and watched the television series with Maury Chaykin and Timothy Hutton. The books are very much alive today, almost 80 years after Fair de Lance was first published. And Mr. Wolfe and the irrepressible Mr. Goodwin are very much with us. They are present. They are present still, as few other characters are. Their names, and that of their creator, are known to mystery fans and the general public alike. Mr. Wolfe and Mr. Goodwin have been portrayed on film, radio, television, but never, to the best of my knowledge, on stage. This presented a challenge. Could it be done? Could they be brought to the stage? Might I be the one who tried to do it? As the saying goes, I might as well be hanged for a sheep as a baa lamb, so why not see if it's possible? Find out if it is. Well, finding out turned into a four-stage process that, from initial notion to full production, will ultimately encompass 3.5 years. I'll briefly describe those steps for you. First, Ira Gershwin was once asked, which comes first, the words or the music? Gershwin's response was, the contract. In other words, before I typed a single word, it was essential to find out who controls the dramatic rights to the Wolfe stories and to gain his or her permission to adapt one of the works in the corpus. In 2010, I'd served as one of the readers for the Nero Award, and I decided to ask Jane Cleland, who oversaw the Nero Awards process. Jane suggested that I write to Carol Novak, who very kindly forwarded my query to Rebecca Stout Bradbury. Rebecca responded, and we entered into a discussion via email that led, ultimately, to my presence here today. I'm terrifically happy to have had the opportunity to meet you, Rebecca. Obtaining the dramatic rights took a while, about a year, all told, I'd say. And I understand, in retrospect, why it took time. It was not a small decision to make. Legal documents do not grow overnight. But they do grow. They can indeed come to fruition, as this one so happily did. With the question of dramatic rights settled, another question presented itself. Which book or story to adapt? I considered any number of titles before deciding on The Red Box. I love old-time radio, so the background of And Be a Villain was very intriguing. I spent a lot of time thinking about The Second Confession. Please Pass the Guilt had the 1960s network television world as a background, which offered certain possibilities in these days of Mad Men and Kennedy-era nostalgia. I liked Murder by the Book and its typists and manuscripts and its glimpse of a vanished publishing world. Several of the novellas were very tempting, but which one should I choose? I continued reading and rereading until I chanced upon The Red Box. I hadn't read it before, actually, or if I had, it had been such a long time before that reading it again was like reading it anew. I liked The Red Box for several reasons. The novellas I'd contemplated using didn't have quite enough action for theatrical purposes to sustain an evening, whereas the novels I've been looking at had too much action. This is a purely technical consideration, by the way. It's not a judgment on the books, all of which I love dearly. The Red Box struck me as having the right amount of plot and a number of characters. I could trim and condense when necessary without damaging the story or the characters. The fact that it was one of the lesser-known titles was also a strength. It would be unfamiliar to many, and perhaps even offer a few surprises to Wolfe aficionados. It's a good, strong, early outing with Wolfe and Goodwin, and it possesses all the charm and zing we expect from them. So, The Red Box. All right. How to, or perhaps where to, begin? I began by reading. I read and reread the novel until the paperback threatened to fall apart. Then I read it some more. When I was done with that, I read it again. And then again. Perhaps a dozen times in all before I put pen to paper. I immersed myself. I soaked myself in The Red Box. While I read, I had certain aesthetic considerations in mind that shaped how I viewed the events and characters of the novel. These considerations vary from play to play. For instance, Ellery Queen's Calamity Town is, among other things, the story of a town that is torn apart by a crime. Queen's book presents a rather panoramic view. So I opted for, in the case of Calamity Town, overtly theatrical devices to characterize the town and its inhabitants. loose narration, direct address, multiple casting, lighting shifts, non-realistic set. An easy and I think reasonably accurate way to describe the approach I took is to call it Our Town with Murder. Now, The Red Box uses a smaller canvas. It was first published in 1937, and it seemed appropriate to utilize the mainstream theatrical conventions of the era. In other words, the convention of the well-made play. One set, a limited number of characters engaged in recognizable, psychologically motivated behavior. The play should be compact, fast-moving, intriguing. Above all, it should be entertaining. So based on these choices, I decided that Wolfe's office in the brownstone would be the sole setting. I shortened the time frame from a week to 3 days to heighten the tension. I eliminated several smaller characters and simplified certain aspects of the plot. In one instance, I moved the action of a scene from upstate New York to Brooklyn because Archie and Saul Panzer could get to Brooklyn faster. The agreement between the Stout Estate and myself allows for this, by the way. I couldn't change the title. I couldn't change the killer. I don't see why I would want to, but other than that, I was given a pretty free hand, which I greatly appreciate. I believe mine is a faithful adaptation, even if I've made some alterations along the line. I believe it's true to the spirit of the book and to the larger issues of character and relationships that animate the series. My goal was to bring Nero Wolfe and Archie Goodwin to the stage. I had no desire to re-envision or reinterpret two of the most famous characters in American writing. I had no political or psychological axes to grind. I'm an unabashed fan of the series, and I saw no reason to set my adaptation on Mars or underwater or indulge in any sort of postmodern deconstruction of motive and character and narrative. That said, the demands of the theater did require a little to-ing and fro-ing to make the transition from page to stage. The shift from first person to third person is one of those demands. The books, as we all know, are narrated by Archie Goodwin. As Walter Mosley has pointed out, Archie's voice is a true American voice and qualifies, perhaps, as Stout's greatest achievement. We view the action through Archie's sensibilities. It's one of the prime pleasures of the books, this time we get to revel in Archie's thoughts. But the theater requires that the subjective be set aside for the objective. I use a limited amount of narration to begin and end the play. Archie sets the scene, as it were, and closes it for us. Elsewhere, I've tried to take the qualities of that subjective voice, Archie's humor, his insouciance, his demotic elegance, and apply them to what the theater revels in, dialogue. And this is where Mr. Wolfe steps to the fore. If Archie is colloquial, Mr. Wolfe is formal. If Archie is pure American, Mr. Wolfe is redolent of Europe. Both of them speak in marvelous and entirely characteristic ways. Their use of language is part of the comedy of manners that constitutes, in my opinion, the strongest reason for the continuing appeal and popularity of the series. Simply put, Archie Goodwin is the irresistible force. Mr. Wolfe is the immovable object. Crime sets the conflict between the two in motion and lends gravity to their struggle, a struggle that is resolved by the solution of the crime. I'm reminded of something W.H. Auden once wrote. He said, "When truly brothers, men don't sing in unison, but in harmony." Nero Wolfe and Archie Goodwin meld their different personalities and their different gifts, and by doing so, restore a kind of order. They harmonize beautifully. This is the music we return to again and again and provides such lasting pleasure. With these and other considerations in mind, I went to work. When I had a draft completed, I had two trusted readers take a look at it, and then I incorporated their suggestions and comments into a new draft, which I sent to Park Square Theater. We now come to the third part of the process, a 3-day workshop of the play that culminated in a private reading. This took place at Park Square Theater in late September and early October of this year. It allowed me to hear the play aloud for the first time, meet the director and the cast, and most importantly, to make revisions based on what I heard and saw. I was relieved to find that no wholesale rewrites were needed, but I made many small changes and cuts. I added material here and there, fleshed out a character or two, straightened out a sentence. Clarity is essential for a play. An audience member can't turn the page back to reread. So one of my responsibilities as a playwright is to make sure that information flows smoothly, that no snags exist to catch a spectator's eye or ear. As you can imagine, this is especially important when dealing with a mystery. I know the play is sharper and clearer because of those 3 days in St. Paul. Work like this can only happen in a room with a talented director and a group of superlative actors. This is where the transformation of dramatic literature into theater begins. It's an exciting and inspiring place to be. There's only one place more exciting, actually, and that's the fourth stage in the process, actual performance. For the theatrical event only takes flight in the presence of an audience. All the preparations, all the work, all the joy, all the worry are in service of those moments. I'll tell you, I'm very much looking forward to that part of the process. It begins on May 30th of next year, when previews commence, and reaches another level on June 6th, which is opening night. The play runs through mid-July. And if you can see it, if you have the opportunity to come, oh, I wish you would. I think you'll enjoy the play, I really do. And I know that Park Square will make you feel right at home. Park Square is one of the great success stories of the Minneapolis-St. Paul theater scene. It's grown and thrived, economically and artistically, over the years when other theaters have failed to do so, brought down by fatigue, the economy, or changing times. Happily, Park Square keeps moving from strength to strength. They have a gorgeous 350-seat theater in downtown St. Paul, and the resources to really make the production sparkle. I can't wait to see the interior of that brownstone. The quality of the work is just stunning. It's going to be a good show. That brings me to the end of the four steps of the process, and I find myself here in the present moment, where I'll do my best to answer any questions you might have. Before I do that, let me thank once again Mr. Ira Matetsky and Marilyn Schaffer for allowing me to be a part of today's assembly. I'd like to thank Jane Cleland and Marilyn and Carol Novak for their early and valuable assistance. And I'd like to thank Rebecca Stout Bradbury for her kindness, her patience, her enthusiasm. And I'd like to thank all of you here today for so generously lending me your ears. Thank you. Yes, ma'am.
I am a subscriber to Encores and Concert here in New York, mm-hmm. Woman of Mar as well. And those are every single form musical with good music and sometimes musical that are adapted mm-hmm. for a concert performance. David Ives is a frequent adapter of the book. Mm-hmm. And hear him talk, he talks about the process, how he does the adaptation. And one of the things that comes up sometimes, particularly from the older works, is he has to reshape the language or the jokes in particular for a more modern audience. Did you find that a challenge with these or not so much?
In this case, not so much. It is indeed often a problem. There's a kind of, I mean, there's a transmutation between dialogue in the book and the kind of shifts it has to go through to come out as spoken language. Ideally, what people will hear will sound like the book, even though in many cases it's not drawn directly from it. There were very few references, I thought, that were time-specific in that sense, that had to be changed or updated. I did try to use period lingo, as it were, and make appropriate period references to help, to place it. But in the larger sense, of the sense that Mr. Ives was speaking of, no, I didn't encounter those problems. So, yeah. Yes, sir.
How was the director and the actors chosen? And do you have a role in that at all?
The short answer is I didn't. The next short answer is I'm very happy with the director and cast that have been chosen. Park Square casts from the Minneapolis-St. Paul acting community, which has opened up a great deal since the Guthrie disbanded its permanent company. Actors who never used to work at the Guthrie primarily are now free to float throughout the community, as it were. And there's a vast, talented pool of actors there. I talked with the artistic director, Richard Cook, about the characters and about the play and about the kind of feel. I gave the director a copy of Baring Gould's book, Nearwolf, you know, West 35th Street, which he has been given, then he's given things to the designers, costume and set designers, as guidelines. But I feel like I lucked out. You know, it only takes one bad apple to I shouldn't say that, one less than perfect bit of casting to ruin a play. And I feel that, I feel everyone in the play is just remarkable. Some of them knew Rex Stout, some of them knew the books, some didn't, some came to rehearsals with a copy of the Red Box in hand. So I thought, okay, we're spreading the word, that's good. So I didn't have any direct control over the casting, but I hope I helped shape the kind of outline for the actors they cast. And I'm very pleased with who indeed has been cast. Yes, ma'am.
Have you ever thought of having whatever local public television station in your area film it and present it on public television as a fundraiser program or just a general thing? Because they do a lot of that type of thing. I live in the Boston area, mm-hmm. and they'll have like a local production of some sort.
Yeah, that would involve a whole other set of rights and arrangements and such, which are not as of yet, you know, part and parcel of this. That said, I would love to say, I mean, it would be delightful, but it's kind of outside of the purview of what, what we're up to now, yeah.
It would be on public television, and then they might show it out here.
I know, that would be fantastic.
Require more lawyers.
Yeah.
I want to know why.
Yes, sir.
The books are set in New York. New York is the center of the acting community. Why the Twin Cities? And most of the members people who would come live in New York. The bulk of the Wolfpack and the bulk of the theater community is here. Why Minneapolis, St. Paul? And actually, I have a lot of friends there, and I like Minneapolis, St. Paul. It's not what I would think of when I think of this.
It actually has a very strong and vibrant community.
Support the Guthrie.
Well, in dealing with there you go. In early talks with Rebecca and Frank R. Curtis, the Stout family's lawyer, they asked. We agreed that it would be good to have a couple of theaters to approach, you know, so we're not doing this theoretically, as it were. So I thought of Park Square Theater in St. Paul, I have a relationship with. I thought of the Vineyard Theater here in the city, and I thought of the Vertigo Mystery Theater in Calgary, which this season is dedicated to mystery plays, classics and new adaptations. If the Vineyard had snapped at the bait, we'd all be going to the Vineyard in June or at some point. Park Square. Richard Cook knew the books, knew the television series, and really was enthusiastic about premiering the work there. I would hope that a New York theater will...
American All-Star Theater.
There you go. That the play will eventually be done here. I would be thrilled if that were the case.
Yes,
of course.
It's very common that a play starts not in New York.
Oh, yes, right. Yeah, a little something called The Lion King, which has been running for a couple months now. Actually tried out in Minneapolis, yeah. They spent months there.
And I just want to add, I think I was the first person to book tickets. I'm going on
June 29th,
where they have a discussion after.
Fantastic. You will be most welcome. Yeah.
Another question.
Yes, ma'am.
Well, just considering how critical the moment of introduction the audience has to the main character.
Mm-hmm.
What was your approach to that, to sort of introducing that particular flavor of intimacy between Archie and Nero when you were writing it?
I had to strike a line between, how to put it, some audience members will be aficionados, will know the books backwards and forwards. Some will not. So I had to start off. That's why I began with Archie, with a bit of narration drawn from the book, but also relating to the brownstone, the running of the household. You know, it's not long, but it helps, I think, paint the scene and his relationship to Nero Wolfe. And then we will see in their interchanges and the way they deal with each other their customary ways of behaving. It's not only the story of the red box, it's the, I hope that I show at least, you know, the major aspects of what life on, in this case, 918 West 35th Street is like. Yeah, the address changes, as we know. So I think that's what I tried to do. Make it understandable for any level of Wolf reader, let us say.
Last question, Katie.
Yes, ma'am.
Since I'm assuming the play will be incredibly successful, have you given thought to the next venue?
A bit, yes.
Or the next book.
That as well, sure, yeah, yeah. I mentioned the Vertigo Mystery Theater in Calgary. I think they, based on some conversation we've had, I think they may be a likely company to produce it. Others, we shall see. Rebecca and I were speaking about that very subject earlier today. I would love to see the play done in more locales, other locations, other theaters. I think it's a good play, and more importantly, I think it helps spread the word. You know, readers, people will come to see it who love the books. People will come to see it who may have read one or two or none. And I think, if we've all done our jobs well, we'll go to the books. You know, it's part and parcel of the life, the continued life of the books, and their place in the lives of so many readers, and I would hope spectators.
Thank you.
Yeah, make it this
to you. Thank you.